This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, we welcome back to the program good friend Dr. Chris Peterson. He's the Homer Nolan Chair of Consumer Responsive Agriculture and Professor of Agricultural Food and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. He is also the Director of the MSU Product Center Food Ag Bio. Chris, welcome back to the program.
It is a pleasure to join you once again.
Chris, I also would be remiss if I didn't mention that our good friends at MSU Ag Bio Research help support the work of the Product Center.
Absolutely, as do the folks at Michigan State University Extension.
Chris, you are celebrating 10 years. Can you believe it's been 10 years from now? Remind our listeners when this all got started. What is the purpose? What's the mission, Product Center?
Well, in the latter part of the 1990s and into the early 2000s, the watchword was value-added agriculture, the notion that we really needed to not just think about agriculture as the commodities that come off the off the fields or out of the barns, but it really has to be about the products that those things get converted into, thus the name of the Product Center. And originally we were the Product Center for Agriculture and Natural Resources, and subsequently we morphed the name into the Food Ag Bio to better reflect the fact that we're working directly with entrepreneurs, brand new entrepreneurs, as well as existing businesses that want to take a new product or service to market that has something to do with food, agriculture, or bioproducts. And it has been an exciting 10 years. We've actually done, I think, very, very well. And I'll give you a couple of the 10-year statistics. We've actually now had over 30,000 one-on-one client sessions 10-year period.
Wow.
We've assisted roughly 2,800 clients in developing a first business concept. The 2,800 went on, 1,500 of them went on to actually start up their business. And then of those 1,500, over 350 actually created economic activity. That is, they really launched the business in some significant way. And so we are immensely proud of that record of accomplishment. Of those 350-some ventures, that represents about $320 million of annual new sales.
Wow.
In the state, and 1,700 jobs created and retained over the 10 years. So we're thrilled.
That's a remarkable track record that over a 10-year period. Chris, when you look back over those 10 years, you mentioned all of these client meetings, those that came to fruition with businesses that are generating economic revenue. Can you give us a couple of examples of maybe a couple of those businesses that are maybe near and dear to your heart?
Well, I think one of the ones that we're very, very proud of is all the work that we did with the Michigan turkey producers. Primarily, we were able to use our designation by USDA as a cooperative development center to work with them in developing their cook plant and all of their branded products that have just been immensely successful in the marketplace. So I think as a very big project, that was something that we're very proud of. Another project is Legends of the Lake, which is Great Lake whitefish. Those independent fisheries were really going to go out of business. And there was one year as we started to work with them that the wholesale price of a pound of Great Lakes whitefish fell to 99 cents. And the industry
that was not sustainable.
That's correct. So we helped the fisheries come together over several years, form a cooperative where they could increase the quality of their product. They can they created a brand name. They now go to market under the Legends of the Lake brand name. And now we're talking about $6-7 a pound for wholesale and a really high quality product, and it's been an immense success. At the other end of the continuum, we've helped lots of smaller organizations develop a whole bunch of specialty food items, salsas, jams, jellies, a tremendous number of gluten-free products. I mean, the range of things that that we've gotten into across these various entrepreneurs and existing food processors, it's been wonderful.
A range, a spectrum that 10 years ago you could scarcely have envisioned.
Yes, I think we had our hopes 10 years ago, and I think of myself as the entrepreneur who started the Product Center, and it really has been an exciting ride.
My guest is Dr. Chris Peterson, and he's the director of the MSU Product Center Food Ag Bio. Chris, as you look forward, let's talk about the next 10 years. You look at the Michigan food and ag and bio sector. Michigan certainly has some advantages. There's been a lot of good news in that sector. What are some of Michigan's major advantages going forward?
Well, I think it is still the fact that we have an incredible diversity of agricultural goods here in the state, both in terms of what happens on the farm and then the ability to process those into specialty foods and other end consumer products. And I think we have a unique opportunity to pull together that diversity of product with the fact that, unlike some other places, we have an abundance of water. We have a strong food processing industry that, in fact, has the potential to expand, I think, even dramatically. And those are the really, really positive things. And one thing that we are working on as the Product Center is the creation of a Food Processing and Innovation Center for Michigan State University, where we're going to be able to help the more middle to larger size food processor actually come and do product R&D. We're going to be able, on a plug and play kind of basis, to have them create a whole production line right on the floor of the center. And they'll be able to experiment with different ways of processing. We're going to have a spiral freezer. Now, this all depends on getting the money to have it happen, but we do have a very extensive business plan and feasibility study. It's roughly a $5 million project, and we're now moving into the fundraising phase of that.
So this R&D capacity, and correct me if I'm wrong, that fills a niche. Some of the larger companies, I would think, like the Kellogg's and the Gerber's, have their own capacity. You're talking about more of a mid-tier and smaller operation.
Correct. We're talking about the $5 million to even $50 million food processing operation. Where in many instances they're operating at capacity or close to it, such that they really can't use their own production space to really experiment with a new product line that might help them move dramatically into a growth phase. And so they're going to be able to rent the facilities, come in, do their work. They can tap into the expertise of our packaging and food processing faculty here on campus. Even we hope, we think there'll be opportunities for senior undergraduates and even graduate students to do internships with these kind of businesses on the processing side. I think there's a remarkable array of things that can be done with a facility like this, and there isn't a facility like this in the Great Lakes region that we represent. And particularly with this flexible plug and play idea, I think we're going to have a unique facility that can really help generate growth in the sector.
A facility that brings together and leverages a lot of resources that Michigan State already has, but doesn't
Correct.
Necessarily work in sync.
Because in essence, if you begin to imagine that we have the Food Processing Innovation Center and connect that to the dairy lab and the meat lab, the packaging labs on campus, and there is also a plan being developed out of food science to dramatically reinvigorate the fresh fruit and vegetable processing possibilities. If we could get all of these assets in place, MSU would truly be the food university.
Well, Chris, the Product Center, 10 years of entrepreneurial activity. You're looking at the next 10 years, and as we speak, you're right in the middle of this new entrepreneurial activity. I mean, what a great story. Congratulations on your 10-year anniversary, Chris, and best of luck going forward with the Product Center.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Join the MSUAA family, and you're instantly connected to our network of over 500,000 Spartans in every corner of the world. Whether it's community, connections, career growth, or class, that's what the MSU Alumni Association is all about. Join the world's largest Spartan Nation community at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, we welcome back to the program someone who was here just recently. He's John Quackenbush. He's the chairman of the Michigan Public Service Commission. John, good to see you again.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
The last time you were in, it wasn't too that long ago, we were talking about several reports that were underway looking at Michigan's energy future. These were reports, as I recall, that Governor Snyder commissioned as an offshoot of his special message on energy and the environment. I know you have been very busy, along with the Michigan Energy Office, compiling these reports. Impressive amount of work. These reports were all released in November and in early December, I believe. But tell us a little bit about the process. Give our listeners a little bit of background on the process that went into gathering the information for these reports.
Yes, Governor Snyder delivered his special message on energy and the environment about a year ago. It was right after Thanksgiving in 2012, and he asked for 2013 to be a year of information gathering. And he directed specifically the areas of energy efficiency, renewable energy, and electric choice as being the core areas that the Michigan Energy Office and the Michigan Public Service Commission should seek information on. We gathered input from the public. We asked for all the stakeholders in Michigan to provide information. And we did that through a series of public forums around the state. We had seven of them in different areas, and through a website where we asked 100 questions and we received thousands of answers.
And the folks in your office and the energy office had to go through all of those responses, both the public forums and the website responses, and come up with these reports. Let's just quickly, before we get into some of the details, I think renewable energy speaks for itself. When we talk about electric choice, what exactly are we talking about?
Well, electric choice is a provision of the Michigan statute. The legislature determined in 2008 that there should be a 10% cap on electric choice. A choice customer is one who chooses an alternative electric provider other than the incumbent utility that serves them. So this customer would take generation services from an alternative provider. There's a 10% cap on it, and there's a lot of comments we received were either on both sides of the issue. There were reasons why people thought we should perhaps raise the cap. Some people thought we should eliminate the cap. Some people thought we should take the cap down to zero, basically. So those are some of the core issues there.
Okay, so just so our listeners know, when you're talking about energy and you're talking about sort of a three-phase, you're talking about the creation of the energy, the distribution of the energy, and the transmission of the energy. When you're talking about incumbent providers, you're talking about the familiar names, I would imagine, Consumers Energy, DTE, and those kind of folks, right?
Yes, those two names you mentioned provide more than 80% of the customers in Michigan with electricity. There's also some municipalities and some other smaller utilities, but those would be the incumbent providers that provide generation to their customers unless the customers choose to procure generation from someone else.
And again, that 10% cap then, the 10% is what in Michigan, by law, the other than the incumbents can provide, 10%. So 90% is provided by the incumbents, up to 10% can be provided by these independents, apparently.
Yeah, there are calculations that our staff makes, as directed by the statute, that looks at the total sales of the utility and determines how much load, how much power can be procured through choice, and monitors it and makes sure that it stays within the parameters set by the legislature.
So I read, as long as we're on this, I read that executive summary. Some states have quite a wide range of choice. Other states have basically incumbent providers. What was the feedback you got about opening up that 10% cap to allow for more free market, essentially?
Well, you're absolutely right. Some states are totally into what they call restructured or competitive markets, where everyone has the choice of which power provider to choose. There are roughly 17 states, depending on how you count them exactly, but somewhere 16 to 18. Everyone can agree there's that many states that do that, including the District of Columbia. And then there's other states that don't have any choice whatsoever. Michigan is a fairly unique state.
We have a hybrid, yeah.
It's a hybrid, absolutely. So it's a, we can maintain the hybrid nature of it, or we can decide we're all in or all out. There's three potentially different outcomes from this review this time around.
And I think we want to make it clear to the listeners, the purpose of your reports was information gathering that's going to be used to inform policy. The purpose of these reports was not to make policy.
Absolutely. The reports do not contain recommendations. They contain summary of the information that all parties provided us. The governor intends to make recommendations, and of course the legislature will take action at some point through statutes.
Let's go to the renewable energy report. Some interesting findings. Give us some highlights of what you found from the feedback in terms of renewable energy.
Well, one thing we did was we asked parties to assess where we are today. The 2008 legislation that we've been referring to set a 10% renewable energy target by 2015, and we're on track to meet that today. So that's number one. Secondly, we asked people to compare Michigan to other states. What are other states doing with renewable energy? And we got a lot of good, useful information on that. There's some states that are doing a lot more. There's some states that are doing a lot less. But we do value generation diversity, and adding some more renewables helps that along. Now, we don't want to do it at that at any cost. We don't want to build renewables if they're very expensive. Well, we're pleased to find that the cost of renewable, particularly onshore wind, has declined quite dramatically thanks to technological advancements and the capacity factors on these wind machines are much better than we anticipated even as recently as 2008. The cost per megawatt hour, which was thought to be over $100 at the time that legislation passed.
About half of that, yeah.
Absolutely. We're in the $50 to $60 range, and we've even had one contract we approved at $48.
Mm. Now, that drop in the price of generation of wind energy has been somewhat of a surprise for all parties concerned. Going into the renewable portfolio thing, there was quite a bit of a concern about whether that cost would eventually drop, and clearly it has.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the taller towers have helped, and the bigger blades. 80 meters used to be was probably, I'll call it, state of the art at the time that the law passed. Now 100 meters is available, and in Michigan that makes a big difference right there. We have a much better wind resource at 100 versus 80, as well as electronic technological advances within the turbine itself have advanced, and now we can get capacity factors which were thought to be maybe in the high 20%, above 40 now.
And when Michigan hits that renewable portfolio standard, John, then is it fair to say that maybe 90% of the renewable energy will be the result of a wind turbine?
Yes, we're anticipating about 94% of it will be coming from wind. There's a couple other technologies like solar, biomass, anaerobic digesters, and landfill gas that make up the remainder.
Now, one of the interesting things in your report, you looked at different scenarios related to increasing that renewable portfolio standard over a period of time. And what did you find?
Well, we looked at not only the cost, but the technical feasibility of doing that much. And we found that we can go up into the 20 and 30% range. Now, on top of that, there's always a concern you hear about wind or other renewables dealing with intermittency.
Right.
And so we sought comments on that, and we found that the independent system operators that are multi-state entities that manage the transmission grid in different parts of Michigan. We have MISO, the Mid-Continent ISO, and we have PJM for a portion of Michigan. Those two entities both had comments that they've been able to integrate renewables, intermittent renewables, at the 20% level and even at the 30% level with no problems. Now, there's some work they have to do, but they have tools and techniques to manage intermittency.
My guest is John Quackenbush. He's the chairman of the Michigan Public Service Commission. We're talking about four reports that he was personally involved in and the Michigan Public Service Commission regarding Michigan's energy future. The findings on those different scenarios suggest that, and let me translate what you just said, Michigan could go to 20% or 30% renewable by, what, say 2035, without any appreciable increase in cost to the consumer?
Well, it would be at a favorable cost. You know, when Michigan needs generation, we can obtain it in several ways, but wind certainly on an economic basis would compete with gas generation as looking like the most two economical sources of new build generation. We also have energy efficiency, which we'll talk a little bit more, I believe, but that is probably perhaps the lowest cost source of a resource we have to draw on in the power area.
You know, one thing that struck me in the numbers, and those numbers were very helpful in terms of generating energy, the low cost of wind generation, the low cost of natural gas, but then the higher cost of some of the traditional energy sources like coal, or clean coal, as I think you put it in your report.
Yes, you know, we do in Michigan today depend on coal for the majority of our power. There are environmental regulations that have been formulated over the recent past that continue to be made and be taking effect. And some of the coal plants will add environmental equipment through significant investments to provide cleaner emissions. And other coal plants, which maybe are smaller and older, it's uneconomic to add those environmental pieces of equipment. So those plants, there's a number of them around the state of Michigan and around the country, that have plans to be shut down?
Well, we've talked a little bit about the report on renewables. We've talked about electric choice. Let's not neglect the third one, and one that I know Governor Snyder is very keen on, and that's energy efficiency, energy conservation. What were some of the findings from your public forums and your web feedback on that one?
Well, just like on renewables, we asked the question, how have we done with our existing targets? The legislature, again, in that same piece of 2008 legislation, set targets that said we would like 1% savings on the electricity side through energy efficiency programs annually, and we would like 0.75% on the gas utility side of savings. And, you know, they didn't flash cut right to those numbers in 2009. They provided a ramp-up period, and in 2012 and 2013 through 2015, we have those targets of 1% for electricity and 0.75% for gas. In every reporting period on a statewide basis, our utilities have exceeded the targets that were set. And so we've done that, and we've also done it on a cost-effective basis. We figure it's comparable to $20 a megawatt hour of what we've paid to procure these energy efficiency resources. And for every dollar that was spent on energy efficiency programs in the year of 2012, we figure customers will get a little bit more than $4 of savings.
So $1 leverages $4 in terms of savings. And by these energy efficiency programs, these are the programs that we could all sign up for relating to our homes, windows, all sorts of different programs, electric vehicle capacity, all of those things that people like consumers and DTE Energy are providing their customers.
Yes, the electric and gas utilities that provide service to you have programs available. Oftentimes, you can find them, the information on their websites, or call the utilities directly.
John, we're closing in on our second segment here, but for people who want to read these reports or the executive summaries like I did, where can they go?
They can go to michigan.gov/energy. That's our website. It has the entire history available there of all the comments that were received, the reports that we prepared, and it's all there on that website.
Michigan.gov/energy. That's an easy one to. Well, I want to commend your office, certainly, for the work that went into preparing these reports and the fact that they were all released on time, on target. And when does the governor expect it to make his recommendations based on reading of these reports and the findings that you came up with?
Well, it's anticipated that it will be soon. Perhaps by year end.
Well, we'll look for that. I've been talking with John Quackenbush. He's the chairman of the Michigan Public Service Commission. John, thanks you. It's good to see you again. Thanks for coming back on Greening the Great Lakes.
It's been great. Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome Peter Worf to MSU Today. Peter is still the relatively new radio station manager at WKAR, MSU's public radio outlet. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Russ. I've really been looking forward to this. It's been 6 months now, but I've been having fun, so time flies.
I'm glad to hear it. And start by telling us a little bit about your background.
Sure. I came here from Chicago, where I was at two radio stations in the previous 12 years. The first was Chicago Public Radio, WBEZ, where I produced a local news and arts and cultural daily radio magazine. So we'll talk more about that later, I'm sure, as we get to the topic of KAR's current state. And then more recently, I was the manager of WFMT, the classical commercial station, one of only two commercial classical stations remaining in the country.
And what attracted you to MSU and WKAR?
Well, actually, before Chicago, I was at KBIA, the University of Missouri's NPR station. So I had that experience with the NPR and music station in a major university environment, too. And I really enjoyed that. I did that for nearly 10 years, then moved on to Chicago. But, you know, I always felt like I would return to a university station, and I always kind of thought I would come home. So here I am back in Michigan, KAR and MSU, just were like a dream come true for me.
And Peter, with smartphones, and we've all got computers, and the whole digital world we're in, what kind of is the state of terrestrial radio, it's called, for most people, maybe over the air, traditional radio, as there's so much competition for our attention, to what's kind of the state of this beloved medium?
Well, I think as we were speaking a little bit before this interview, you sort of have to be everywhere all the time, you know. When we go out and capture interviews for Current State or for our local news coverage on the NPR programs, or even during our classical programming, everybody brings a camera, too. I mean, we're expected to provide, multi-platform content for people who are using KAR. They want to see what it looks like. They want to see what we're doing. They want video. They check in with slideshows that we create when we're talking about a place or a person or an event.
You find increasingly, then, that Is the audience migrating more towards WKAR.org than WKAR on the air, or is it still a mix?
It's a mix. You know, radio listening is not a huge growth area. We're strong. I think public radio has remained strong. We have exclusive content via NPR, and here in mid-Michigan, speaking to terrestrial radio, KAR sort of owns that classical music piece. And then we have local programs like Sports Talk and others that are exclusive and local to 870 AM. So those audiences on AM 870 and 90.5 FM have remained strong relatively over the last 5 years or so. Of course, we're membership organizations, too. So that's a measure of our audience. And people are very good and very generous to us, and we appreciate that. But we're seeing tremendous growth, especially over the last year, in seeing how many people are using KAR.org, looking at content, watching slideshows, seeing video, exploring everything that we have there that's in addition to our AM and FM stations. And honestly, our Facebook reach has increased tremendously, very steadily over our one sort of main page. And on our 90.5 classical page, basically doubled our reach in the last 6 months. So
it's not really that people are leaving listening on the air, but you're gaining new people through the internet.
I think everyone in their use of media is just using more and more things. We're turning to more and more places. I mean, that's what everybody does.
Well, tell me a little bit more, Peter Worf, my guest on MSU Today, the manager of WKAR Radio at Michigan State. Where do you want to take the station, and sort of what are your plans now that you've been here for a while to keep it relevant?
Well, Gary Reed is the director of broadcasting of both KAR Radio and KAR TV. Susie Elkins is my counterpart at the TV station. She's the station manager. And all of us want to work together at expanding local programming. We need to sound like, to look like this place, to look like MSU, to look like the Lansing area and mid-Michigan, and really sort of the greater Great Lakes area as well, exploring what's happening at the Capitol and everything between the lakes. We need to do more of that if we're to survive in a public broadcasting environment that is often threatened by the loss of funding sources. We can't just simply play CDs or turn the network news key for a few hours each day. We need to be creating new local programs like Current State, like What's New on WKAR. That's our local new release program that focuses very much in every program on local performers, local arts. We're looking at opportunities where we can collaborate with KAR TV. One idea that we've talked about may be a music Quizbusters with Matt Ottinger. I think he's enthusiastic about that. I know Susie and Gary and I are. I think that would be a lot of fun, too.
We'll talk more about Current State, which is the new one-hour, 7 days a week
right.
program. Tell us what that is, what you want listeners to know.
This was another idea that Gary had wanted to create since before he came to KAR a year and a half, almost 2 years ago. And it's just the right program at the right time. As I also said earlier, you're seeing other stations around the country develop a local news and arts magazine, a program that is almost required listening for people who are curious and caring about where we live. So you put together the planning that Gary and I have done over the last 6 months and more. A tremendous producer, also from Chicago. I didn't know him when I was there. Joe Lindstroth also came from BEZ in Chicago, Chicago Public Radio. And then a guy who was so plugged in to what's happening locally, and a tremendous broadcaster, Mark Bayshore. He's our host. And really, I was almost shocked at how quickly the show got off the ground about a month ago. You know, you sort of expect your bugs and your
sure.
sort of shakedown period, your shakedown cruise. And, you know, we had that and we're having that. But my gosh, I thought we got that thing off the ground to 10,000 feet pretty fast.
Agreed. Now, what about the role for classical music? You're trained in it yourself, a big fan of it. That's another one of your new programs. Some stations have just given up on it completely. Is there going to remain a role for the classical programming on KAR?
There definitely is. We have a very loyal classical listenership, a long and loyal one. The classical music at KAR has been in place pretty much since our existence. And over the last decade to 15 years, you've seen more and more broadcasters dropping out of that classical music model, or even that sort of block format, that sort of mixed format model of news and classical music. But there are those out there who've succeeded. I think KAR is succeeding with it, and that we will. And it's about focusing on local programming. We've just developed the new MSU faculty recital series with 5 concerts this academic year. I think that brings an excitement, an immediacy, a locality, an exclusiveness to our content. Just last week, we had the MSU Symphony Orchestra with Kevin Ngo conducting a Beethoven symphony and John Adams' Harmony Lara. So you had some classic standard repertoire, and then music of the 20th, 21st century. It was incredibly exciting. Jody Knoll hosted that in such a relevant, immediate way. And, you know, it sounded like us. Nobody else had that. You can go listen to classical music anywhere. It's on Pandora now. You can go to your CDs or any other classical radio station on the web and hear a lot of great stuff. So we have to be about us.
Good point. That goes back to what we were talking about before. There's Pandora is another one of the many options out there for people. So remaining local and relevant to your audience is really, it's always been important, but I guess going forward in this digital age is going to be even more important.
You know, the other thing, speaking to classical music, Pandora, of course, started off with a more sort of pop and popular rock and country and broader model of more popular music, non-classical music. But then they moved into the classical music area and succeeded. But you won't find a live symphony concert from MSU. You won't hear the Lansing Symphony, the Jackson Symphony. Things that are about how we sound.
And it's about local and staying relevant to your community, which is even more important. Peter Worf is my guest on MSU Today. He's the radio station manager at the venerable WKAR at Michigan State University. And if that name sounds a little bit familiar to some of you slightly older listeners, Peter is indeed the son of Mike Worf, one of the most famous and recognizable names in the history of radio in the state of Michigan. And I had the pleasure of working with a little bit at WJR towards the end of his career. But talk a little, I'm assuming your dad influenced how you got even a love for radio yourself.
Well, how could you not be influenced by a guy who had a radio station in the basement? Well, I should say a radio studio, who took me to the Fisher Building every, few weeks on a day off from school or during the summer to hang out on the 21st floor and see J.P. McCarthy and Carl Haas and, bug the guys in the newsroom and, all the secretaries and, throw paper airplanes down onto Grand Avenue and explore that amazing record collection that they had for so many, many years. Yeah, that was a huge influence on me.
Because your pieces to me even sound a lot like your dad. So I guess a lot of it just comes through osmosis, maybe.
Well, thanks for saying that. I think about a show that's very popular on public radio right now. Probably the most popular radio show since Garrison Keillor and, Prairie Home Companion 20, 25 years ago. You take a guy like Ira Glass and the amazing This American Life, a person who tells stories about the famous, the infamous, and the unknown through excellent writing, narrative, music, archival sound, personal interview. Everything old is new again, right? that's what my dad did.
For he's a trailblazer and he was ahead of his time at the same time, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
Just update people on what he's doing, happily enjoying retirement, I would assume?
Well, no. He's happy, but...
That's right, he wrote a book recently, at least one.
He actually just finished a second book about American popular song composers, and their book's based on these personal interviews that he did back in the mid-70s in New York and Los Angeles with guys like Harold Arlen, Sammy Kahn, Sondheim, I think, was one of the interviews, Johnny Mercer. I mean, famous songwriters of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. From Broadway, from the movies, and just popular songs that people listen to on the radio, during the war years. It's amazing what this guy was into, my dad, over his career. And then he found these tapes a few years ago that he had featured on Kaleidoscope and thought, wow, these are pretty good. I should make them into a book. And they actually became two books published by McFarland out of North Carolina. And they're available now. American Popular Song Composers and American Popular Song Lyricists, two books.
Well, Peter Worf, as we wrap up, just summarize what you'd like those joining in on our conversation to know again about WKAR and where you want to take it.
Well, there are many new things happening, both in our news and information area and in our classical music. And I hope that listeners will stay in touch and let us know what they think and let us know what they'd like to hear. But we're growing, we're creating new things, and we're staying local.
And you can sample WKAR on the FM dial at 90.5, on the AM dial at 870, and these days online at WKAR.org. Peter, thanks for joining me on MSU Today.
Thanks a lot, Wes.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to a half a million Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome back to Greening of the Great Lakes Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, who was recently in Lansing to attend an agriculture and climate change conference sponsored by the Agricultural Leaders of Michigan. Senator Stabenow, always good to see you.
Well, Kirk, it's really great to be back with you and to be a part of a very important discussion right now of what's happening in terms of weather changes, the severe weather that's affected our farmers and ranchers in Michigan and all across the country, from the droughts of last year to the warming up north last year and then the late freezes that wiped out our cherry crop for last year. Fortunately, that's not the case this year, but we're seeing real volatility and changes in the weather, and that's a very important thing to discuss and what we can do about it.
Senator, now that this climate change really is no longer a debate, the scientific evidence is clear. Farmers aren't typically your most liberal people in the world, but from your experience, they get it on climate change, don't they?
Well, the reality is, I mean, they are where the rubber hits the road. I mean, you know, the reality is they're seeing, on the one hand, a longer growing season, but much more volatile. We've seen temperatures going up. There's more water usage. There's concern about droughts. But we're also seeing these great storms that have come that you just don't know what's going to happen because they're much more intense. We did a hearing last February on severe weather in the U.S. Senate Agriculture Committee. And one of the things that we heard from the folks involved in monitoring this through the USDA is that we always have storms, but issues around climate change are making those storms longer and much more severe. And so that's having a tremendous impact on this. There are things we can do. Farmers are really leading the way when we get into how we manage crops, how we keep more carbon in the soil, no-till practices, cover crops that keep soil on the ground are very important. Using bioenergy, taking the waste from the farm and turning it into energy with biodigesters. More farmers are putting solar panels on the roof and using wind or hydro or other kinds of technologies that are getting us off of oil and have less of a carbon footprint. So I think, as usual, Michigan farmers are going to really be ahead and leading the way nationally.
In your remarks earlier, Senator, you mentioned the solar panels on a dairy farmer here in Michigan actually paid for the panels over the course of 3 years. But it's good for the environment, but it's also good for the bottom line, right?
Oh, there's no question. Energy efficiency is good for the bottom line. And so that's why I think this is a very important conversation. It's a win-win. Yeah, it's good economically. And at the same time, it's good long-term when we look at the fact that if we are moving to a low-carbon economy, we've got long-term savings as well as direct short-term savings. And by the way, the long-term savings are in things like crop insurance. We've seen in the last year much more being spent in outputs and indemnities through crop insurance than we have seen in the past because of the severity of the droughts, the severity of other wind and other, you know, storm-related kinds of activities, flooding and so on. And so we've got more payout coming to cover the risks that are happening, which cost taxpayer money, cost the individual farmer money. So we save in a number of fronts. When we're able to mitigate the risks, then we bring down the costs of dealing with severe weather, and we also, through energy efficiency, increase more money in the pocket to farmers.
And the Farm Bill is in conference now, and I must say, in the Senate, it's been an excellent bipartisan effort that you've spearheaded. But linked in this Farm Bill, these are the things about conservation and energy efficiency. There are major titles in the Farm Bill that you support. Are those going to endure through conference?
I feel very confident that our strong, new and improved conservation title is going to make it through into the final bill as well. This really strengthens various tools that we have available to partner with farmers on better management of land and water, protecting our resources, dealing with runoff into our waters, and so on. The energy title that we have is different than what the House has in that they have a title, but they don't have any real funding in it. So we have real funding in ours, and I'm confident we'll end up somewhere in the middle on our energy titles.
And I know you've got to run, but the last question, again, you're in conference, the proceedings, you're sitting there at the table with a lot of your counterparts in the House and in the Senate. Are you confident we're going to get this Farm Bill done?
I am confident. We have to get it done. 16 million people whose jobs come from agriculture in our country are counting on us to get it done. And I said to my colleagues, this is a chance to show that we can govern. That's what people want us to do, come together with common sense and govern. And we've got to make sure we don't let those folks down.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I've been talking with Senator Debbie Stabenow, who's been working for quite a long time on the Farm Bill in a very bipartisan way. She chairs the Senate Ag Committee. Senator Stabenow, always great to see you.
It's great to be with you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.